He's still going to count them, maybe with some different intentions and some different even breakdowns in what age group gets numbered. In the first census, how many people are counted? What's the number that you guys came up with in that question six? Oh, no, question five. What was the number of the men? Something like that. I think I had 603, 550. Whole lot of people. And one of the things that's interesting to me about that, very seldom in any of the upcoming battles that you're going to read about, is it ever going to come down to, well, we've got enough men versus how many men they have. Most of the battles that we're going to see in the conquest and all of that, it's not by number that they're going to win their battles. In fact, if they usually end up losing just a few people, they recognize that God's not with them and they've done something wrong. So I just thought that was interesting. What was the number in the second counting? And it's about 40 years later. Question six. I had 601,730, chapter 26, verse 51. So rather than just go through all of the specific questions on this, let's talk a little bit about what's in some of the various chapters. And I'm going to encourage you, if you've got some questions or comments on any of the events and stories that we read through on this, raise your hand and bring that to my attention so we can talk about them. Who wrote the book of Numbers, as far as we know? Moses. Basically, when we've talked before, the first five books, the Pentateuch, are attributed to Moses, even in the New Testament. Numbers chapter 33, verses 1 through 2, it talks about God telling him to write down some of the events in what happens here in the book. And the book starts off, where are the Israelites located? Yeah, they're at Sinai. If you remember from the book of Exodus, they got to Sinai. They stay there as the law is given to them. And before they head off, they're going to be there for a substantial amount of time. Anybody know how long they stay at Sinai before they head down towards Canaan? Yeah, it's just about a year's worth of time that they're going to spend there. And we're still going to be at Sinai for about the first, I think it's the first 10 chapters or so in the Numbers before they depart and go down. One of the things that God points out in chapter 2, he's going to talk about when they travel and when they camp. I don't know if you guys recognize the idea of if we've got 600 plus age 1,000 fighting men, not counting women and children and older folks, there may be in the millions of people, of how many people are in the desert. There probably needs to be some type of order and coordination on what that looks like, what travel is going to look like. And God spells that out and gives some rules and regulations. Whenever they camped, what was usually in the very middle of the camp setup? Tabernacle, right? Tent of meeting. God has that in the middle. And then he's got surrounding that a number of things. First of all, he's going to have some of the Levites that are camped directly around the tabernacle. And he even specifies where they're going to be. Moses, Aaron, and the priests, as well as the tribes of Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, are going to be on the east side with the priesthood folks closer. On the south side, he's got the sons of Levi, the Kohathites, close by, and then Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. West side, he's got the Gershonites, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. And then on the north side, he's got the Merarites, sons of Levi, and then Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So I don't know if you saw some of the charts on that, but basically it's just this well-organized camp of many thousands of people around the tent of meeting. One of the things that gets talked about in chapter 3 that I thought was interesting, and we talked about numbers. One of the things that he does is he numbers the Levites from age 1 month and older. And you might not think that's really that important, but anybody write down what that number of people was that he found for the Levites that were in the 1 month up and older? There were 22,000. In addition to that, he does another numbering. He does a numbering of the first born males of Israel. And what was that number? And my understanding is this may be like those that were first born just in that recent time period. Because again, if you're going to count up 600,000 people plus, there's probably more than 22,000 that are firstborn. But I think this is a dedicated, the people that were probably born either since they've left Egypt. But it's the firstborn since God has made this rule and regulation, I believe. The number that he comes up with that is 22,273. So let's read in chapter 3 just so you can understand kind of what he does here. 3 and verse 39, it says, "All who are numbered of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered at the commandment of the Lord by their families, all the males from a month old and above were 22,000. Then the Lord said to Moses, number all the firstborn males of the children of Israel from a month old and above and take the number of their names. You shall take the Levites for me, I am the Lord, instead of the firstborn among the children of Israel, the livestock, the Levites, instead of all the firstborn among the livestock of the children of Israel." So Moses numbered all the firstborn among the children of Israel as the Lord commanded him, and all the firstborn males according to the number, names from a month old and above, were 22,273. He's basically going to say, take these Levites, and they're going to be mine instead of the firstborn of Israel. And he says, those extra 273, I want you to take 5 shekels for each one of them and give that to the Levites as payment or tribute. So he does this redemption thing of basically purchasing or buying, redeeming those firstborn with the Levites for himself. So a very interesting kind of picture of what he does here in dedication of replacing the Israelites with the Levites. What are some of the duties of the Levites? And I guess first of all, question number 8 talks about the 3 sons of Levi. What were the names of those individuals? Gershon, Kohath, Merari. Each of these individuals were assigned, and their descendants were assigned a specific duty when it came to taking care of the tabernacle, when it came to taking care of service of the work that God has given them. And God spells that out pretty clearly in chapter 3. What was the duties of those that were the Gershonites? What did they do? Okay. Chapter 4 kind of spells out in detail what all of that is. The Gershonites took care of things such as the coverings, the curtains, the hanging things in the court, the screens, some of the instruments of service. How about the the Kohath descendants, what was their duties? Can't hear you. Holy things, they took care of oils for the lights, incense, meals of offerings, some of the furnishings. And then how about Merari? What did those Levites do? Yep, they took care of the structural elements of the tabernacle. The boards, the bars, the pillars, the sockets, the cords, ropes. So I don't know if you guys remember the way Andy kind of remembers that. It's kind of silly. Gershon, he says, are the girly things, because it's curtains and things like that. The Merari is the manly stuff, because it's the boards and bars and sockets. I don't know. That's my brother. And then I guess Kohath, I don't know if that's the kitchen utensils. It's the K. Anyways, however you want to remember that, they had a dedicated thing that they were supposed to take care of. And God basically spells it out and says, only these descendants will take this down. When they took it down, there were certain ways they had to wrap it and carry it. When they assembled it, it was the same thing. God had a structural approach and design on how he wanted to do this. And even within the priesthood, within the Levites, they were not to change or cross-contaminate some of that. God wanted them to do it a specific way. So I think there's some lessons there learned in God's approach on how he wants to be served. And it's not something that we can just on our own come up with and make our own attempts at. We will see portions of that, not only here. We saw some of it in previous books when some of the priests tried to offer some strange fire and got it from a place God didn't want, and they were struck down dead. I guess before we keep going on this, let me just ask, do you guys have any thoughts on maybe what some of the main themes or lessons from the book of Numbers that you came up with on? What are some of the main lessons that you think God wants us to get out of this, or even wanted to get the Israelites to get out of the events in Numbers? Sam? No, good lesson. That's exactly right. We don't, as far as I know, we don't have God reaching down and striking us with fire today when we complain and grumble. But we worship and serve the same God that the Israelites did. God was very patient with them. God gave them instructions. God provided for them. And like Sam just mentioned, there's attitude problems. There's unthankfulness and grumbling. And God's not pleased with that. So it is something I think that we have to be mindful of. Mary? Okay.
Job you're given to do, and
good. And not just maybe complaining or jealousy towards the leadership, but even within the leadership. You're going to have Aaron and Miriam griping against Moses and basically saying, hasn't God spoken by us as well? There's some discontentment there. Just like what you talked about with the order of the camp. Even when they traveled, there was an order to how that went. I think it was Judah. I think Judah was supposed to break camp first, and then they were supposed to travel, and then the other ones were assigned on when they were to go. And yet, with all of that, who was in charge of not just the order of it, but when they went and what that looked like? That was God. How did he let them know when they were time to pack up and travel again? Yeah, the cloud would move that was over the tabernacle, and I don't know exactly what that looked like, if it went up in the sky and they knew it was time to go and packed their bags. Doesn't give us all the details. I think it's chapter, maybe it's 33 or 34, I don't know if you guys looked at any of that in detail, where it goes through and it specifies from when they left Egypt, and it talks about every time they broke camp. Need to look real fast. I think it was 33. Israel journey from Egypt reviewed. Yeah, that's, look through 33 when you get a chance, and it talks about every time they moved from one place to the next, and there's dozens and dozens of times that they had to break camp and travel, and all of those were led by God, and all of those he told them where to go and led them on that. So I thought that was interesting. So good. Some of those lessons, we don't want to grumble. God is orderly, and we need to follow his rules and orders on things. Attitude, make sure we've got the proper attitude, and all of those are things that the Israelites failed in. And again, the New Testament reminds us these things happened to them as examples so that we would not set our hearts on evil things as they did. Chapter 5 talks about some purity laws and regulations. It also talks about the idea of if a husband thinks his wife is unfaithful, there are some things that they could do to go to the priest and have the priest determine if that was true or not. Chapter 6 gets into the idea of a Nazirite. What was the idea of a Nazirite vow, and who could make this vow? Was it men? Was it priests? What was the Nazirite vow? Who was that for? Tim. Okay. It was men or women could dedicate themselves as a Nazirite. And I don't even think that it was necessarily that it had to be for a whole lifetime. I think you could pick a period of time. I'm not sure if Paul's was a Nazirite vow or a vow. But in the New Testament, I think Paul makes a vow. And I think that talks about in here how to end your vow period on what you need to do at the end of this establish the end of your vow. You would shave yourself and purify yourself afterwards. What were the things that somebody that took a Nazirite vow could not do? What were they to keep away from? Okay. Okay. So no wine, no strong drink. It got into nothing to do with grapes, not the skins or the seeds, no raisins. Raisin bran was right out. I don't know what all of that necessarily had to do with, but it was something that was part of God's, I'm going to purify myself away from this particular thing in my dedication. And was mentioned they could not cut their hair. So they didn't cut their hair. I assume that also meant they couldn't shave their beard. And anything to do with a dead body. So there's clean and unclean. They had to keep themselves clean and away from the dead. Said even if a family member dies, you can't go touch or be around that dead body until your purification is done. So, any comments about that? Okay. Chapter 7 talks about the leaders and princes of Israel doing some dedicated service and bringing some offerings before the altar. All the tribes go through and do that. And then in chapter 8, it gets into the idea of the Levites being separate and cleansed for the work that God has done for them. In 11, let me see. No, I got that wrong. Sorry. 843. Nope, I got that wrong too. 824, I think it is. It says, this is what pertains to the Levites. From 25 years old and above, one may enter and perform service in the work of the tabernacle of meeting. At the age of 50 years, they must cease performing this work and shall work no more. They may minister with their brethren in the tabernacle of meeting to attend the needs, but they themselves shall do no work. Thus you shall do to the Levites according to their duties. So the reason I wrote this down, I wanted to ask you guys, early on in the book, it talks about the age that Levites were to serve. And it mentions, remember what age it says that they could serve at? To be a... Okay. Yep, if you look early on in the book in chapter 4, it says from age 30 to 50. Talks about that with all of the groupings, the Kohathites, the all three. I'm not going to say the names because I'll mess it up. But here in this part of the chapter 8, it says from 25 and... There's some discrepancies there, and I was curious if you guys had any thoughts on that, if anybody had studied it, or what that might entail, why it would say 30 up in the early chapters, and then here it says 25. I don't have the answer. Mary and I were talking a little bit about it before class, and she could probably say it much better than me. What was your observation that you were making earlier? So that makes some sense to me. The actual work that they would do started at 30. And at 25, they could come into, I guess, almost like an apprenticeship. It doesn't say that word, but it's the idea that they could come and begin the process, I guess. And just like what she talked about with the offering that was given, when the sacrifice offering was made, it wasn't killed immediately. There was a time period that it sat before it was sacrificed. If you look at chapter 8 here, this is where that representation that the Levites for the people is given. Verse 10, it says, you shall bring the Levites before the Lord, and the children of Israel shall lay their hands on all the Levites. So the Levites cleansed themselves, they purified, they shaved themselves. they went before the people, and in verse 12 it says, after the people had laid their hands on the Levites, then the Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the young bulls, and you shall offer one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering to the Lord. Verse 16, for they are wholly given to me from among the children of Israel. I have taken them for myself instead of all who opened the womb, the firstborn of all the children of Israel. So again, I think it's that idea of redemption. God said, I'm going to take the Levites unto myself instead of the firstborn of Israel. And that representation is shown by the Israelites, after the priests are pure, putting their hands on the Levites, and then the Levites putting their hands on these sacrifices that are offered. Some cool symbolism there as we get into the New Testament idea of our sacrifice and God, through Jesus, taking our sacrifice, our sins upon him. We don't lay our hands on him, but it's the same idea. He takes our sins upon himself, and not only does he offer the sacrifice, but he is the sacrifice. Any comments before I keep going? Chapter 9 is going to talk about the second time they partake of the Passover in the wilderness, or away from after it's been established. And there's another thing that's brought up. Anybody know when, what day the Passover was actually on? 14th day of the first month. And in chapter 9 here, they come up with a backup plan. So if there are people that are unclean, if there are people that are away traveling and can't partake of the Passover feast, what does God develop for them so that they can still participate? Anybody remember? So on the second month, on the 14th day, they would have like this makeup Passover feast for those that couldn't participate during the first one. So I thought that was very interesting, something that we don't really notice or pay that much attention to, but God made provision for those that could not because of whatever the uncleanliness was, or if they were out of town, he makes this second opportunity for them. Again, chapter 9 also talks about how the cloud would move and travel, and they would follow it. And basically it says, verse 22, whether it was 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud remained above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would remain encamped and not journey, but when it was taken up, they would journey at the commandment of the Lord. Chapter 10 talks about the idea of these two trumpets, these two silver trumpets. Did anybody read that? And what was the purpose of these trumpets? Sam. Okay. That's right. So you didn't have a speakerphone or cell phones or any of that. So maybe the cloud would go up, but they would have these trumpets. If they blew both of the trumpets, all of the Israelites were supposed to try and come to the tent of meeting in the center so that they could hear what the announcements were. If they blew one of the trumpets, the heads of the tribes were to come. What else were the trumpets used for? Alarm. I don't know what the alarm sounded like. Going to battle, they would blow the trumpets, or the, yep. Feast days. If you read through this, there's a whole specification of things that they would blow these trumpets during, almost like an announcement of, it's time to do this thing. So I don't know how they taught everybody what these trumpet blasts were to sound like and what they represented, but is that any different than even a couple hundred years ago? Didn't they use trumpets and all of that for battle to communicate attack and charge and retreat? And so I think God did it before the cavalry did. Chapter 10 is when they pack up and they leave Sinai. And you might think, okay, here we go. We've got our law. We've got our tabernacle. We've got our order. We've got our fighting men numbered. We're ready to go. And here we go to Canaan. How far did they get from Sinai before they had problems? 3 days. They get 3 days and the grumbling starts, the complaining starts. And they're unpleased with God that they're out here. It's probably not a comfortable situation going through the desert. How does God respond when they start to grumble? What does he do? Sends fire down and burns some of the people. Moses, I was curious what your thoughts are on this. Well, one of the things I guess I wanted to mention from 11, it talks about, because one of the themes that we maybe didn't mention earlier besides complaining, the Israelites looked back a lot. If you remember where they came out of oppression and slavery and just a terrible, terrible situation that they cried out to God, help us from here, help us get out of here. And God does. He sends them a deliverer and gets them out. And yet now in the wilderness, a year later, they're looking backwards and they're saying, they yielded to intense cravings. They wept and they said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlics. But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna. And they were looking backwards to the garbage that they had left, the slavery that they had left, and said, we want to go back there. And if we don't have the right attitudes, can that not all be also be something that we can do? And look back and say, you know, the sin world was enjoyable. There was pleasures there. And forget all the consequences. Forget all the negatives that God has delivered us out of. And I just think that's one of the lessons I need to make sure I pay attention to on this is God has delivered us from something that we don't want to look back at and try and go back to. And he was unpleased with that. What is Moses' response to this in the same chapter? What is Moses say to God?
Well, he's as an intermediary, I guess, feeling the most pressure. Why am I? I'm not responsible. They were handed.
God, why have you given me this people to deal with? And I'm sure he's feeling a lot of pressure when the people are rebelling against God, but in a way he kind of complains to God too and says, why have you put this on me? And he even says, why don't you just kill me now? Just strike me dead and let me be done with this. Which maybe there's some lessons there for us too. God gives us a service to do and we don't want to get the attitude of, God, why have you given me this service to do? Even Moses was not maybe who he should have been with this. What is God's answer to him? What does he give him? Did you have a comment, David?
Yeah, so in verse 4, it says that the cause of their grumbling was because of their greedy desires.
Okay. Good. And I don't know that there's symbolism meant in this, but what was their food that God fed them with? Bread or manna from heaven. And they said, we want meat. Give us some meat to eat. fleshly? I don't know, right? Is there some symbolism there? We want this physical thing that's going to satisfy our cravings. And God says, you want meat? I'll give you meat. What does he send to feed them? Quail. How much quail? Yeah, I think it talked about, like, when the quail were blown in from off the sea, that they were like 2 cubits deep around the camp. That's a lot of quail. And not only were they selfishly gathered even more of that than they needed, and God said, I'm going to make it come out your nostrils. You're going to be so tired of eating quail. He said, I'm not going to give it to you for a day, not 5 days, not a week, a month, you're going to eat quail. So they got to the point where God says, you want it? You got it. But he also gives Moses some help. It says he kind of picks 70 men that he gives the Spirit to that are going to help him deal with these people. So Moses kind of gets his answer as well. He doesn't have to do all of this on his own, and God provides. So, yes, Larry?
A question that's always puzzled me. It seems like in chapter 9 that they're required by God to observe the Passover in the wilderness.
Okay.
So if they're observing the Passover in the wilderness, wouldn't they be sacrificing lambs?
I would assume so.
And so if they had lambs, why would they not have meat that they would desire or complain that God would send the quails? I've always been puzzled about that.
Yeah, well, I don't read anywhere that they did not have lambs or cattle. Did they not have those things when they were in Egypt? I think they had those things. I think in Goshen, that's where they kept all their critters because the Egyptians didn't want them. And when they left, I think they brought that with them because part of the rules were you consecrate your firstborn sons to me, but you also consecrate the firstborn of your animals that are born to me. So I don't think that they're animal-free, and I think they were making sacrifices, so I can't answer your question on why they would grumble about not eating meat unless God didn't want them eating that right then. I think they were still dedicating that to the priests, right? I think the rules of how the Levites and the priests were served food was from the Israelites and the dedication that they brought. So I guess I don't know the answer to that. So you can ask Andy and Rick when they come back. Just got a couple minutes here. We brought up the idea before of chapter 12. There's some dissension from Aaron and Miriam towards Moses, and they basically say, well, what was their gripe to Moses? What were they upset about?
Aaron and Miriam thought that they had as much right to be leaders as Moses.
Okay.
And complained about him taking the leadership control.
That's right. There's another thing that's mentioned as well. What did they gripe against Moses about? They weren't pleased with what he did. It says something about he had a Cushite wife that they did not agree with or were pleased about. And doesn't necessarily sound like that's what their real gripe is. I think they're picking on him about something, but it really comes down to their hearts. And then one of the verses in chapter, I think it's in 12, that... it's always been a little funny to me. It talks about, what does it say about the character of Moses? Yep. It also says that he was more humble than any man. He was very meek. So he did not take that upon himself. And my guess is God made him write this down because... If Moses is writing this book, it just always struck me as funny that he wrote down Moses was the meekest man ever. What happens when Miriam and Aaron complain about Moses? What does God do about it?
God
Miriam is struck with leprosy, right? And Aaron looks at her and probably realizes he's next. And they apologize and they say, "We're sorry." And Moses, on their behalf, goes to God and says, "Please don't hold this against them." And then what does God have Miriam do? She is sent outside the camp for 7 days to be purified, and then God takes away the punishment. And again, there's a number of symbolisms, not just here, but part of those rules and regulations. Anytime there was impurity, when there was leprosy, when people had some type of bodily discharge, where were they sent? Outside the camp to keep the rest of the camp pure. So I think, again, there's probably some examples there for us to pay attention to of God wants us to be pure and not to have impurities in us or in our number or in what we do. So we're basically out of time. I know I didn't get that far, but we got through about 12, and I'll let our next teacher know that we'll start in chapter 13, where we're going to look at getting ready to go into the promised land. So any questions before we finish up our class? Okay. Was that recorded? Oh, too bad. I was hoping there was no evidence. So, all right. Thanks, guys and ladies.